I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
On this edition of Parallax Views, you'll hear part two of the Parallax Views tribute to the great author of sci-fi, fantasy, and speculative fiction, Harlan Ellison. In the last episode, we spoke to Cultured Vulture's Ben Arzadi, author Joshua Ellis, and Zero Books' C. Derek Varn about the life and legacy of Harlan Ellison, who passed away in his L.A. home on June 28th, 2018, but not before leaving the world with an array of cult classic short stories and other fantastic writings. In this episode, we'll continue the tribute with two more guests. The first, John Barbour. Film critic, documentarian, actor, and television personality, who many would argue founded reality TV with his show Real People. And then, author Robert Guffey, who recently wrote his own science fiction novel, Until the Last Dog Dies, among many other works, and who has been deeply influenced by Ellison's writings over the years, even using them in creative writing classes. But first up, my conversation with John Barbour, in which we talk about John's career in showbiz and his interviews and experiences with Harlan Ellison. Welcome to Parallax Views, John Barbour. You there?
Oh, yes. I thought you were going to say something else. I love that name, by the way, Parallax News or Views, because one of my very favorite movies was Parallax View. And when I was a critic at NBC, I was offered the part as the senator in that film. And I declined it. I was offered often parts in movies, but I turned them down because I thought it would be a conflict of interest for a critic to be ending up in movies. And I'm really sorry I passed it up. It's a terrific movie. Anyway, it's a delight for me to be here talking to you today. And thanks so much for the invitation.
So I wanted to have you on because Harlan Ellison just passed away, the great sci-fi author, and you interviewed him a few times for your shows. But let's first get into how you got involved in television and your show, Real People.
Well, first of all, you're lucky that Harlan is not alive, because anybody who ever referred to him as a science fiction writer, even if they said he was one of the three best in the world, they were in for the most obscene, profane attack you have ever heard. He always considered himself primarily a writer, but we will get to that a little later.
I was going to say he often said that he's more in the line of Kafka than he was any sci-fi writers.
That, yes, there's no doubt about that. And it'll be interesting chatting with Harlan, because I think he did his last public interview with me shortly after he had his stroke last year. And that's in the archives on BBS Radio. But everything that happened to me in television, and I must tell you, almost everything that happened to me good in life happened totally by accident. And all the really horrible things that happened to me were the things that I thought were really well planned. I got into television quite by accident. I became a stand-up comic because I kept losing parts as an actor. Tell you very quickly a very, very brief story. I was up for a part in a pilot. The pilot was called Manly in the Mob, and it was written by Chris Hayward and Alan Burns, who wrote created the Munsters. And by the way, their agent sold the Munsters to Screen Gems as his property. And Alan and Chris spent 10 years in the courts getting it back. But in any event, there was a pilot being done by ABC called Manly in the Mob. And Chris called me and said, hey, Freddie DeCordova, who later became the producer of The Tonight Show, wants to talk to you because they're looking for sort of a Bob Newhart lookalike. Anyway, I talked to him, and they were testing 31 people. I was the 32nd person to be tested. Manly in the Mob was a ripoff of Peter Sellers' Inspector Clouseau, as is everything in television. It's a ripoff of some other success. In any event, two of the last guys being tested were George Carlin and Elliot Gould. Elliot Gould was married to Barbara Streisand, so I didn't think I stood a chance of doing it. It was written by Jerry Gardner and Dee Caruso, who used to write jokes for John Kennedy. Anyway, they all failed, and I was the last one to be tested. And when Freddie called me, I said, could I say something to you about your script that you gave me, the 3 pages? And he said, yes. I said, this is supposed to be a ripoff of Peter Sellers, but there's nothing in here that indicates that the guy's a goof up. Can I invent some pantomime goof up to show that it's a funny script? He said, yes. I did so. The test was an enormous hit. And ABC said, they finally discovered the script was good because of my test, but they didn't want me in the lead part. They wanted Paul Lynde. So I had beaten out Elliot Gould, and I'd beaten out George Carlin. And I called Freddie and I said, you know, America's not ready for a gay leading man yet. Let him be my sidekick. They said no. So I finally said to Freddie, why was I on the list, for crying out loud? He said, John, you were on the list because they didn't know you, so they had nothing against you. Now they know you're a heterosexual. So anyway, they did the pilot. I had the third lead and lost that. So shortly after that, I decided I'm going to stick to being a comic. And in that day, it was around 1970, a company in America could only own 7 radio or television stations. The worst president in the history of the country, Bill Clinton, signed the Communications Act in 1993, and now 6 major corporations own 95% of all the media. It's a monopoly and should be disbanded and destroyed and returned to the people. It's no longer the public airwaves. Anyway, all these stations could be challenged, and ABC had morning movies, and they were being challenged by Chicano groups in Los Angeles. So they decided to dump the morning movies and do a morning information show. Now, I'm a stand-up comic, and I'm doing very well. There was a very famous announcer in L.A. by the name of Mario Machado, Hispanic. So it looked like they were going to give him the hosting job. Now, get this. He saw me at the Ice House breaking in material where Steve Martin started. And he said, John, I just auditioned for this show. Why don't you go over and audition for it? And I said, not a host for kind of a lot. I'm a comic. He said, but all your stuff is about the news. Why don't you go and do it? And so I did it, and I got the job quite by accident. And that's how I accidentally ended up talking to Jim Garrison, because, as you know, everyone in the media was attacking Garrison. The government was attacking him, saying he was an idiot and he was a kook, but they wouldn't let him get into court.
For my listeners that don't know, Jim Garrison did the trial against Clay Shaw involving the JFK assassination.
That's exactly right. But now, he had two charges against Shaw. One was conspiracy, which is what the media talked about, but his main charge was perjury. And he won the perjury charge. But you never heard that. And the federal government stepped in and stopped it. In any event, I happened to accidentally read his book called Heritage of Stone afterwards, and I called to book him on the show. And he said, John, you'll never get away with it. And I said, Mr. Garrison, I just won my first Emmy. I won five of them, actually. And I'm the only one in television to win Emmys for both news and entertainment. So he decided to do the show. And the following week, I was canceled. I was fired and he was canceled. So that's how I accidentally met Jim Garrison. But I never thought anything about that. You know, I thought that's just show business. You never have a permanent job in show business. I was the first one in news to review movies on the air. So I ended up at Channel 11 as a critic. Tom Brokaw saw me on Channel 11 and brought me to NBC. I was there for 5 years, and I was a film critic for Los Angeles Magazine for 10 years. And then I got a call from the most successful producer in the country. He did Funny Girl with Barbara Streisand. He did The Way We Were with Streisand and Robert Redford. And he was a fan of my reviews, so he called me over to his office, and he offered me an enormous amount of money to write an original love story. And I again turned that down, but I told him I had this idea about doing a show about reality television, what I call the entertainment of reality. Because over the news wires, a lot of stories would come that were very offbeat. And it said not for broadcast, but I thought they were great stories. There was one about a stripper for God in New York, a girl who felt her body was so beautifully made by God that she should share it with everyone, and she would tithe to a church. Now, they wouldn't put it on the air, but what a great story it would be. And it ended up being on Real People. And in any event, I turned him down because I said, you know, again, I think it's a conflict for a critic to do that. He reminded me that The African Queen was written by a film critic who used to be with the with Time magazine. So in 1978, I was unemployed. I was 46 years of age, but I said, one day I'm going to change the face of American television with what I call the entertainment of reality. And then again, quite by accident, a year later, Real People was on NBC with four specials, and it did so well that they ended up ordering 22 shows, which never happened in television. They only go for 13 shows. So everything that happened to me that happened really well was something that I had not planned. As a matter of fact, I came from a severely dysfunctional family long before it was popular. So I never wanted a child. And when I lost out hosting on a game show at ABC and came home after 3 years of being married, my wife cried because she said, that means we can't have a child. And I married her and told her I'm not having a child because I didn't know what kind of father I would be. But because I deprived her of that and was unsuccessful, I said, okay, you can have a child. I didn't know that a child was for a lifetime. I thought it was maybe her turn for 3 years. So she got pregnant right away. And I must tell you, the greatest thing that ever happened to me, because I had a career, but with my son, I now had a life and a meaningful life. So again, all these things happened by accident. including my meeting with Harlan Ellison.
Well, let's get into that. How did you first meet Harlan Ellison?
I had, do you recall the Merv Griffin show in Westinghouse?
Yes, I'm familiar with it. A bit before my time, but I'm familiar with it.
Okay, well, I was a regular on Merv's show doing stand-up. When Merv was signed by CBS, that meant he was going to leave Westinghouse and he was going to go to CBS. He recommended me as his replacement. And so Westinghouse signed me at $600 a week. I was free to do my stand-up or anything else, except I could not host another show. And as such, they would want to evaluate me by letting me sit in and sub-host for Merv, which I did. And my ratings were either as good or a little higher than Merv's, because Merv was a singer. He never did an opening monologue. The best late night talk show host ever was Jack Barr, who did a monologue. And that's the reason I became interested in television, because I never knew that people conversed. All I ever heard in my life was yelling. And when I saw Jack Barr actually talking to people on television and earning a living, that's what got me interested in television. Jack Barr and Edward R. Murrow. And then Carson continued with doing monologues. So that's why I became a comic. Anyway, Westinghouse used my ratings as a hammer to get David Frost's demands down. David Frost was a very successful English comic host and interviewer, and he ended up doing a show in bombing. Anyway, the night that I subbed for Merv, the principal guest was an Olympic handsome gold medal winning skier from France. His name was Jean-Claude Keely. The show went great. Jean-Claude was terrific. It was a wonderful show. At the time, Harlan Ellison, whom I'd never met, was doing a brilliant television and film column for the Los Angeles Free Press. It was called the Glass, he called it the Glass Teat, T-E-E-T, which was just a perfect way to describe television. As a matter of fact, one of my dear friends, a fellow named Gary Deeb, who was the best television critic in America, worked for the Chicago Tribune. He once said of television, "Television is the only business in America where competition does not improve the product." You cannot improve upon that line by Gary Deeb. Anyway, when Harlan reviewed me, and he had no reason to review me, I wasn't well known at the time, he called me a faggot in print. But the writing was brilliant. So anyway, David Frost is signed by Westinghouse, and I'm no longer getting $600 a week. But I get a call from a fella named Chuck over at Channel 11 in Los Angeles, Chuck Young, an ex-Marine, and he says that David Frost is going to die, as you predicted, and he's an Englishman. You can't do that show and succeed. And we would like you to come to Channel 11 and do a Saturday night Poor Man's Tonight Show, because when Frost dies, you're going to come back and you're going to do a strip show five nights a week. So that was it. Now we had to book guests. And one of the first people I wanted to book was Harlan Ellison. And I said to the producer, television is the umbilical cord that is going to inform and misinform America forever. It is indeed what Harlan said, the glass tit that Americans visually will suck on. And so he said, but you can't call him. He hates you. I said, that's got nothing to do with, if he's as articulate on the air as he is in print, he's just an absolutely totally wonderful guest. So I said, call him. He said, I'm not going to call him, for God's sake. You call him. So I contacted the Writers Guild. They would not give me his number. So I picked up the phone book, and there was his number. So I dialed it. And this gruff voice answered like in the second ring. Yeah? Like that. Really tough. I said, Harlan. He says, yeah? I says, this is John Barber. He says, oh, holy shit. He said, why are you calling me? And I said, I want you to be on my television show. He said, I beg your pardon. He said, I thought you didn't get it. I thought they had Frost. I said, no, they brought me out here to Channel 11 and they want me to do a show. He said, are you kidding me? I said, no, I'm not kidding you. He said, didn't you read what I wrote? I said, that's why I'm calling. I said, listen, I don't care that you said that. The writing was wonderful. You're as articulate on camera as you are in print. You will be an absolutely terrific guest. So would you come on the show? And you'll get paid minimum. And he came on the show. And, of course, the subject was television. And he was brilliant. Now, he and every show, I'm going to tell you an interesting sidebar to that story in a little bit about Harlan. Every television show I was fired from, and then I did a lot of them in L.A., and they were all successful, and everyone I got, as a matter of fact, I got 2 weeks late night funded by Procter Miles, Procter & Gamble. It was on ABC, and for those 2 weeks, I bumped heads with Letterman, even though ABC had fewer affiliates. But ABC, even though Procter & Gamble would pay for the show, didn't want John Barber on the air because they said I was too controversial because I was booking people or trying to book people like Jim Garrison. So that stood in my way for a long time, but that didn't.
You also had, Dick Gregory on at one point, you know, who was big into the MLK assassination. You had a lot of controversial guests.
Oh, I did, because they were the most interesting. As a matter of fact, my very first comedy album was called It's Tough to Be White. And they were very nervous about, and this was, and if you go to my site, youtube.com/johnbarbersworld.com, you can hear wonderful clips from the album that are as topical today or more topical now as they were in 1966. But my wife had introduced me to Dick Gregory. My wife used to sing for Earl Hines. Earl Hines was once part of the old Louis Armstrong sextet, but Earl Hines was a real gentleman. He didn't like Satchmo's lifestyle, so we went to San Francisco, created a big band, and my wife was the singer. As a matter of fact, she introduced me to Red Fox, who became my mentor when I got into stand-up comedy. And when we did the album, Dick Gregory said, I'll do the liner notes for you. Of course, it did the liner notes, and it was released, and it was a huge hit amongst blacks. But there were only two people in America who would ever play, white people who would play it. One was Bob Crane, who had the most successful radio show in L.A., who ended up doing Hogan's Heroes. And the other was the inventor Angry Talk Radio. It was Joe Pine.
Ah, yes, Joe Pine. He was sort of like the Wally George or Morton Downey Jr. of his day.
Oh, my God, that's an insult to compare him to those guys. I mean, he was the godfather of it. And he had this thing called a squawk box, and people would get up. If he didn't agree with them, he'd tell them to go home and gargle with razor blades. But he loved the album. And I'll tell you something interesting. All of these things are in my book, by the way. I have an autobiography called Your Mother's Not a Virgin, which I promise you will be the best book ever written about anybody in showbiz. Up until then, it was Ben Hecht's A Child of the Century, and it's coming out in April, and all these stories are there. But when I sat with Joe Pine, do you remember the movie Network?
Yes, I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore.
Yeah. When I reviewed it, I said, it's the only movie ever made in America that you go to listen to. It is the most brilliantly written movie ever. There are a lot of, you know, I've seen them all, but Chayefsky's was brilliant. But anyway, there was a point when Peter Finch is called into the owner of the network's house to be read the facts of life about how important money is. It is just the most brilliant speech. But Peter Finch is sitting at one end of the table, and at the other end of the table, which is about 20 feet long, is the owner of the network. That is how Joe Biden had his guest. He'd sit 20 feet from them. And when he was finished interviewing me, he came by and he shook my hand. He said, "I'm sorry I made you sit so far away, but I don't like to sit near anybody that I like." So in any event, that was Joe Biden. Only two people would do that, Dick Gregory. So ABC did not give me the show. And it didn't matter to me, because I ended up quite accidentally doing the first Garrison tapes. And then I finished doing this past year the second one, which has been called the most definitive film ever about JFK and the birth and purpose of fake news. It's called The American Media and the Second Assassination of President John F. Kennedy. But back to Harlan. When Harlan was in school, he had a professor who failed him and told him he did have no talent as a writer. Harlan never forgot or forgave. And that, in that respect, he was a lot like Donald Trump, because every time he wrote a short story or got a script produced on television, or a movie made, or a book made, he always, the first person who ever got a copy of it was that professor. I mean, he was relentless in that respect. And I had the utmost admiration for him, even though after the first show, that we did on Channel 11, the Metro Media Station, I went in on Monday and I got a call from the program director complimenting me on the show. And by the way, I was the first person to put Red Fox on television. And his appearance on my show was seen by Norman Lear. Red ended up in a movie. And then ended up doing Sanford and Son. And Sanford, by the way, is his real name. His real name is John Sanford. Anyway, the program director says, "Would you want to come to my office for a second?" So I didn't know. He was complimenting me on one hand. I thought, oh, well, maybe he's going to fire me on the other hand. I go in to see him, and he's laughing. And I said, "What's so funny?" He said, "Harlan called me and said, John Barber is the worst effing host in the world. He is a faggot, like I said. I would like to host that show." In spite of that, I still always booked him on every show I did. And you will see, if you go to my Facebook page, when I got the 2 weeks late night on ABC again, some of the people, Frank Zappa was one of the first people I put on the show, whom I called the Tesla of Nikola Tesla's music. And of course, the first person I booked again was Harlan Ellison. If you go to my Facebook page, you will see that excerpt from John Barber. It's called The Barber Report. And there's Harlan Ellison. And he is as adorable and charming, as witty as he ever was. Now, I'll tell you what kind of balls and individuality this man had. He wrote this wonderful short story about the Terminator. And it was stolen by Paramount and turned into a movie with Arnold Schwarzenegger. And Harlan said, "I'm going to sue those bastards." Now he's a struggling but successful television writer. He wrote the best Star Trek ever. He wrote some unbelievably fabulous stuff.
Outer Limits. Didn't he write an episode of Outer Limits, Demon with a Glass Hand, I believe?
That's exactly right. I mean, brilliant. It just, his stuff is beyond belief. I mean, to me, it's as good as Nabokov. I mean, just wonderful, wonderful, brilliant, original material. Anyway, everyone in his camp, his agent, his manager, and his publisher, his wife, and his friends said, do not sue Paramount. You will never, ever work again in this town. And he said, I'm going to sue the bastards. He sued, and he won. And he won a very substantial, deserved amount. And you know what he did? He paid a small fortune to put a billboard up at sunset in Doheny. It must have been 20 by 35 feet with very large type that said, I beat the bastards, signed Harlan Ellison. And he never worked more then. He worked more after he won the lawsuit than beforehand, because as you well know, in this business and in this country, people only care about winners.
You know, some of the obituaries that have come out about Harlan, they're kind of like these bittersweet obits where they're like, well, he was a great writer, but he was politically incorrect or stuff like that. And I get the impression that Harlan could be cantankerous, but I never got the impression that he was like a bigot or hateful in any way.
He wasn't. He hated idiots. He hated anyone who called him a science fiction writer. He was cantankerous. He was a curmudgeon, for crying out loud. But he was beyond brilliant. And people have to separate the man's talents from the man's personality. They are entirely, entirely separate. In the, I don't want to get into it now, but I think Mort Saul was an absolute comic genius. And Mort at one point wanted to do the liner notes on my first album, It's Tough to Be White, and I don't want to get into it. As a person, like Johnny Carson, one of the most despicable, vindictive, insecure people I've ever been around. Carson was the worst. Mort Saul personally was the worst. But I love his work. And you have to be able to separate the two. And people just cannot do that. I'm going to tell you something. I made an observation years and years ago when I had Jane Fonda on my show. At the time, it was 1970. The Vietnam War was at its peak. Everyone had wanted Muhammad Ali. As a matter of fact, I gave Muhammad Ali an hour on my show when almost no one in America except Howard Cosell would give him airtime, because most Americans wanted him either shot or in jail because he refused to go to Vietnam. He said, I got more trouble with white people than I do yellow people. And they hate him for telling these truths, okay? Anyway, Jane Fonda at the time was being like called Hannah Jane, and she was very loud in voicing her objections about the Vietnam War. And she came as a guest. I would never have a celebrity on my show unless they were talking about an issue. I turned down Bob Hope because he wanted to come on and talk about his specials. I said, if you want to talk about your support of the war, you can come on. Otherwise, you can't. He never came on. When Jane showed up, she showed up with Mark Lane. And I said to her, now, you have to understand, in 1970, there was such a thing as a fairness doctrine. There was such a thing as equal time. So if I had a Democrat on, I had to have a Republican and then a socialist. And if a Nazi could get 5% of the vote, I had to have them on. There was no such thing as these loudmouths that you now see all over radio and you now see all over Fox television. You could never have a Rush Limbaugh. You could never have an O'Reilly or a Hannity.
A Glenn Beck.
Yeah, you could not have a Glenn Beck because then you would have to give equal time to the liberals. And I'll tell you how it was destroyed. NBC illegally tried to bribe Jim Garrison's key witness in the Clay Shaw trial. And the guy who did it was a fellow named Walter Sheridan, who was an FBI and CIA asset, a so-called producer for NBC News, who was assigned to go down to New Orleans to destroy Jim Garrison's case. He called the lead witness and Perry Raymond Russo, saying he was coming down. He was going to offer him a job in California at $50,000 a year to get out of Garrison's jurisdiction, meet him in a motel in Louisiana. The young man called Garrison and said, "This guy's coming down to tape me, to film me." And Garrison said, "Would you wear a wire?" He said, "Certainly I'll wear a wire." So they taped the guy being bribed by NBC. Garrison brought criminal charges against Sheridan and NBC. NBC should have lost their license. David Sarnoff, the president, should have been in prison along with Walter Sheridan. But what they did is they gave Garrison a so-called equal time, a half hour late night, which you can see partially in my movie and you can Google it on YouTube. He says on camera, "The Central Intelligence Agency murdered our president." The people who own the country saw this and said, "Holy shit, we can't have bistrus being told on television." They disbanded the fairness doctrine. They disbanded equal time. So now anything goes. Absolutely anything goes. Do you know that when I reviewed a movie called Soylent Green, I really trashed the movie. As a matter of fact, I said, I should say something nice about this movie, like the sets are beautiful, but the sets would be more beautiful if they'd been placed in front of the actors. Well, that quote went all around the world, right? The producer of the film brought suit for equal time. It was 5 years in the courts. It's the first movie review ever to go to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court ruled against them because they said John Barber's review was of no public importance. But you see, that could not happen today. You could be maligned endlessly on television, as Trump is and a whole bunch of other people are, and you have no recourse. America's done. America's cooked. And there isn't a political scientist in America that hasn't said for the past 2 or 3 years, it's no longer a democracy, it's an oligarchy.
Well, it's funny you mention that because, you know, I always got the impression that Harlan sort of his stories weren't necessarily political all the time, but he had a lot of political beliefs and he was very anti-establishment. He didn't suffer fools very lightly.
Not at all. And he had right to be anti-establishment. Absolutely. I mean, America is an absolute and total mess. You look at the presidents that we have had since the murder of John Kennedy, and only one seems to have been a decent human being, and that's Jimmy Carter. The others are absolute buffoons. And, you know, it's difficult to evaluate what Donald Trump is doing because you cannot get a proper reading from what happens and what they show you on the media or what you read on the internet. The love for him and the hatred for him is so intense. He is lost in the fog. And I have 2 or 3 friends who are unbelievably bright and intelligent, who are massive fans of Donald Trump. And then I have other friends who absolutely and totally loathe him. I am indifferent to him, as I am. Jack Parr once said on television, "I never vote because it only encourages them." There is nothing America can do. You know, voting in America is as useless as owning stock in General Motors. I have stock in General Motors, and I get to vote every year or every couple of years on what's going on at General Motors. I have no say about the design of the car. I have no say about how much mileage the carburetor gets. I have no say at all. You have no say in America when you vote. And they shouldn't be voting with voting machines anyway, which can be hacked and are hacked all the time. It's a total mess. I mean, America, politics in America, is like the weather. You can't do anything about it, except the weather is better than politics because once in a while there's a sunny day. There is never a sunny political day in America anymore. And fighting these fake wars, I mean, it's just total nonsense. Well, Harlan was against all that. But when you come out against it, you don't get the audience that you deserve. Because free speech in America is still there, but only if you have a very small audience.
And I was just curious, are there any other stories you have about Harlan Ellison?
No, except that, you know, everybody, you should go to, there's a wonderful documentary on HBO about Harlan. I forget what it's called, but it's really good. He was speaking at a college. Just Google Harlan Ellison lecture or Harlan Ellison at a college and you can see it. And, I miss him already, you know, and I was really, really saddened, when he came on my show, because at times he had a little problem with some of his memory, you know, and I think he was married 5 times, and the last time he had a very terrific and loving wife, and I think she died earlier this year. I don't think that helped him survive any longer. So I have no more stories to tell about Harlan. It'll all of those things will be and are in the book, which is Trinde is publishing.
Chris Milligan.
Yes. Oh, I'm glad you know him. He's just absolutely terrific. Anyway, I really appreciate the fact that you wanted to do something about Harlan, and I'm sure there are a lot more successful writers and actors and directors that you can contact who would be more than happy to contribute their tales about Harlan. But again, in spite of the fact that he tried to do me in a couple of times, I so admired his talent and his honesty that I would forever book him. And, you know.
Well, you had him on years later on your BBS radio show.
Yes, I did. I think, as I said earlier, I think it's the last interview he ever did. He said he was still typing, but he could only type with one hand. One half of his body was not functioning. And I just loved him because even with those physical impairments, his mind was still almost there and he was still struggling, but he still had that spark. He was still that renegade. And I love those kind of people. It's like, Hunter Thompson, I'm a gonzo journalist. But again, thank you so much for letting me come on and say my little piece about that. And for anybody, again, who's interested in seeing Harlan, if you go to my Facebook page, it's or Google Harlan Ellison on the Barber Report or with John Barber, you'll see it. And if you really want to see it's an absolutely thrilling documentary, but extremely disturbing. Go to Amazon and you don't even, it's only $2, but you don't have to spend the $2. You can just read the enormous number of unsolicited 5-star reviews about the film. And it is a movie that every American should see, even though you can't do anything about it. Anyway, again, thank you so much for having me on.
But before you go, just if any of my listeners, I have a, probably a bit of a younger demographic. If they're not familiar with Harlan Ellison, what would you recommend they read or movies they could watch that he wrote? What do you recommend by Harlan Ellison to introduce my listeners to him?
You know what I would do? I would recommend that, because it's easier for people to look at a TV set than it is to turn a page. I would recommend that they look at the HBO hour of Harlan. God, if I'd known that you were going to bring it up, I would have searched it and given you the title.
I know, but there's a documentary called Dreams with Sharp Teeth that he did that's very good.
Yes, I would recommend that because the younger generation will see a guy who's very witty and very sharp and very bright. And if they like what they see, and I'm sure they will, then they will find themselves what it is that they want to read of Harlan's, because there's just so much to choose from. It's like saying, what would you tell people to start with if you're going to want them to read Mark Twain? Well, I wouldn't tell them Huckleberry Finn. I wouldn't tell them that because so much. I mean, the letters from Earth that he wrote are unbelievably brilliant. But he was America's first novelist. He was the first person to write like people talk. So, you know, you can't say, I couldn't say where to start with Harlan.
Well, I would also like to say what you said earlier. Harlan was right to say that he wasn't just some sci-fi writer. He went way beyond the sci-fi genre. I think his writing was it wasn't just confined to a genre.
No, you're absolutely and totally right. And again, I cannot say on the air what I have heard him say to two or three very famous, very successful people who in front of me referred to him as a sci-fi writer, and he literally went berserk. So there you go. He was a complete writer.
Thank you again, John Barber, for coming on Parallax Views to celebrate the life and times of Harlan Ellison.
Thank you so much, and have a great Fourth.
Harlan,
that was fairly dull.
there are a lot of people who work in television who don't have much admiration for the medium. I must say that in the last year and a half, half a dozen times I've heard executives, when you hear writers arguing for something that they want to do on television, one of the executives will say, well, it's just television. Mm. Why do so many people in the business have such a disdain for it?
You want a straight answer? You want a funny answer? I mean, working in television is like putting in time in the Egyptian House of the Dead. you work very hard at something, and then anyone who has any opinion at all comes in and messes in it, and they alter it, and you find that it's what Judith Pauline Kael called, it's an art form being run by businessmen, and since they know the bottom line, but they don't understand even how a story is told, they will alter anything to make it convenient for themselves. There's also such a thing as least resistance programming, which means they program most television for the intellectual level of, I don't know, an Alabama redneck. And
do you really think that's true?
Oh, I know it's true. I've been working in the damn medium for 25 years.
No, but I mean, do you think they deliberately say the average intelligence of the viewer is about 12 or 11?
I would love to be able to say it isn't true, but I've heard it said too many times, if not in those words, in saying, well, they won't understand this. And that's called, when they do that in a script, when they alter a script to reach down to people rather than trying to lift an audience, they say, well, we have to dumb it up. That's the phrase they use, we have to dumb up the script. And that's why television is famous for telling you three times. They say, that man's going to come in the door. Then the man comes in the door, he says, he came in the door. You get it three times just in case you missed it. And it's murder for anybody who cares about what they write or what they create.
Well, there's an interesting dichotomy in your career. You wrote these brilliant critiques of television in the Glass Teat when you were doing that column for the Free Press back in the late 60s. And now they're taught in communications and journalism classes around the country. You attack the medium rather viciously, articulately, but viciously. But at the same time, some of the things that you've done in television don't look like the kind of credits that you would want to put on your resume.
What are you getting at, John? What hideous thing from my past do you want to bring up? Out with it, John. Out with it.
Well, I mean, there were some shows that you had written.
All right, I did a Flying Nun. All right, now, I'll tell you, so that you don't think I did it for the money, which is, of course, what everybody thinks all across America, I did it because Sally Field, I wanted a date with Sally Field. That's what, honest to God, it is one of the most bizarre stories. They showed me this pilot before the show went on the air, and I fell desperately in love with Sally Field. She was a knockout and a terrific actress even in that series. And I said, I will do one of those. I said, but I want to be there when you shoot it because I want to meet Sally Field. I figured I might get lucky. Who knew, right? I'm no nobler than you or anybody watching the show, John. And so the problem was that when I was doing the writing, I was at a writer's conference in Milford, Pennsylvania. And I fell afoul of a gang of kids who were stealing cars and robbing houses. And I got into a big fist fight with them. And they sic Kong on me. And the fight consisted of me leaping off the ground to catch him with a left. And I got him in the snout. The single blow I landed, he then proceeded to pound me into the ground. I kept getting up like Cool Hand Luke. He kept pounding me back down. I wound up in the hospital with both hands broken in Milford, Pennsylvania, with these two fingers, which are all I used to type with anyhow. I had this typewriter in my lap, and I was doing this, the script. So the producer keeps calling me, where's the script? I said, all right, so you don't get it. So they put on organ music. What's the big thing? They put it on, and they said, unfortunately, the script was too Jewish. So they had to do some work with the script, and I took my name off it, and I never got to meet Sally Field.
Oh, how sad.
It's crippled me. It's blighted my life.
Did you ever tell her the story? Did you ever meet her at all?
No, I've never met her. Never met her at all.
Did you ever decide to maybe send her the script?
No. You, one of the things you learn is that people who have any degree of notoriety at all, I mean, I have very low-level notoriety, and we had a psycho at the house last week, a bag lady sleeping in my carport. And it's true. And we finally had I have to go after her with a ball bat and said, lady, get out of here. I don't want you sleeping here anymore. And you just don't bother people who have any kind of fame. And she must get a lot of... I didn't bother her.
All right, we're going to take a break right now. But when we come back, Harlan...
You're going to have Sally Field here for me?
No. We'll be right back after this.
Oh, okay.
And what you just heard was a clip from one of John Barbour's classic interviews with Harlan Ellison. Next up, my conversation with Robert Guffey, author of the sci-fi novel Until the Last Dog Dies, as well as Camellio, a strange but true story of invisible spies, heroin addiction, and homeland security, Cryptoscatology, Conspiracy Theory as Art Form, and the upcoming Bela Lugosi and the Monogram 9, co-authored with Gary Rhodes. This conversation is a really special one because it delves into the ways in which Harlan Ellison really tried to help and promote other authors, especially those within the sci-fi and fantasy genre. And of course, we discuss the life and times of Ellison and the importance of his writing. And, in fact, the way that Robert has managed to utilize Ellison's short stories in his own creative writing classes. This one's a real keeper, and I think a great way to cap off the Parallax Views tribute to the late, great Harlan Ellison. Welcome to Parallax Views, Robert Guffey.
I thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So I wanted to have you on for this tribute I'm putting together for the great sci-fi author Harlan Ellison, who recently passed away. How did you first become interested in Harlan Ellison's work?
I was about 14, and I was buying a comic book called Dark Horse Presents, which is still being published today. There aren't a lot of comic books that started being published in the 1980s and are still being published today, but Dark Horse Presents was an anthology comic book published by Dark Horse Comics. And the first issue had this big guy on the cover with a gun and a bunch of skulls, and I suppose my 14-year-old brain was attracted to that image. And I bought it, and I found that cover story didn't interest me as much as the backup story, which was called Concrete by Paul Chadwick, and was about a guy who's made of concrete, and there was no explanation as to why he was made of concrete or how that happened, and I found it charming. And then I bought the second issue to read the continuing adventures of Concrete by Paul Chadwick, and in the back was a letter from Harlan Ellison saying how much he loved Concrete And he also mentioned that he hosted a radio show in Los Angeles called Hour 25, in which he often spoke about comic books. And that was weird to me because I didn't know of any TV show or radio show at the time that talked about comic books. In fact, I don't think I knew any adult at all who talked about comic books. So this would have been like 1986. And so I tuned in to KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles that next Friday night at 10 p.m. And there was Harlan Ellison interviewing Julius Schwartz. And Julius Schwartz, of course, the great editor of Silver Age comic books at DC, and who had been Ray Bradbury's agent and H.P. Lovecraft's agent. And so it was fascinating suddenly being plunged into this 2-hour-long discussion, no commercials, between Harlan Ellison and Julia Schwartz talking about H.P. Lovecraft. And in my mind, I thought H.P. Lovecraft had written stories back in the 1800s. I wasn't really too educated yet about the entire history of science fiction and fantasy and war. And so it blew my mind that Julia Schwartz had been H.P. Lovecraft's agent. And Harlan Ellison would every Friday night for 2 hours uninterrupted have a panoply of these stellar guests on, many of whom are now deceased. And so I would sit there and listen to Harlan Ellison in a conversation with Robert Sheckley or Octavia Butler or Ray Bradbury. And a lot of the times, this was the first time I was ever hearing of these people. I'd never heard of Octavia Butler before. I'd never heard of Robert Sheckley before. And I had in the back of my mind the idea that I wanted to write, but I didn't really know what that entailed. And this was sort of like a master class in writing, and also a big reality check. I teach creative writing at CSU Long Beach, and often I have students who come in who are 18 or 19 or 20, and they have a kind of weird illusion of what writing is going to be like. You know, they're going to write a novel, they're going to publish it, and then they can live off the proceeds for the rest of their life, you know? So perhaps I had some sort of weird fantasy like that when I was 14. It was a big wake-up call to hear Harlan Ellison talking to these working writers about what it was really like to be a writer. And Harlan Ellison, the way he would conduct the interviews was very informal. And he made the guests sort of feel at ease, I think. And he was able to get stuff out of them that no other interviewer would be able to get out of them. And so I remember him interviewing James Morrow, who at that time had just published a novel called This Is the Way the World Ends, which had been nominated for, I think, the Nebula and the Hugo. And at one point in the interview, Harlan Ellison asked him how much money he had gotten for This Is the Way the World Ends. And James Morrow said, "I'm embarrassed to say." And Harlan Ellison said, you know, go ahead, just go ahead and tell us. And he said he'd gotten $3,500 for it. And that was a big, like, wake-up call moment in my brain. I go, oh, okay, I get it. this book, which was a brilliant book, had been nominated for the Nebula and the Hugo, and he'd only gotten $3,500 for it, you know. So hearing these kinds of stories week after week, I kind of began to understand the dirtier side of publishing and how it all really worked. So I think I entered into it with more open eyes as a result of hearing Harlan week after week actually talking about these things, about how the sausage gets made, I guess you could say. And it was very educational, you know. And the way there was one particular episode where he had run a contest. It was a short story contest where listeners could write short stories and send them in, and the winner would be published in, I think, Twilight Zone magazine at the time. Well, Harlan Ellison and the judges, which included, I think, Arthur Byron Cover, J. Michael Straczynski, and Mel Gilden, they didn't find a winner. None of them were good enough to be published professionally. So instead, they dedicated the show to workshopping the story. They took the best of the worst and did a kind of Clarion-style workshop on the air And it was really fascinating hearing the way that Har Nelson conducted the workshop. He would do it in such a way where it was informal and very sort of painfully truthful, but the same way helpful. You know, he never attacked the guy, but he told him what he needed to know to become a better writer. And essentially the way that was the first creative writing workshop essentially I was ever introduced to was hearing it conducted, you know, on the air and the radio when I was 14. And that's where I first heard about Clarion. And eventually I attended Clarion because of hearing Har Nelson talking about it. And essentially the way I conduct creative writing workshops to this day, it probably is sort of, I hadn't really thought about this until just recently, but it's probably sort of subconsciously modeled after that first workshop I heard on Hour 25 and the way that Har Nelson had conducted it. I've heard from other people who actually had Har Nelson as a professor that he could be very, he could actually sort of attack you. I didn't hear that aspect to it on this particular broadcast. I thought he really walked the line very well between being critiquing the story in such a way that it was helpful, but also not not so brutally honest that you're going to destroy the guy's psyche, you know. So I think I sort of conduct the workshops sort of based on that first broadcast I heard. Those broadcasts they're very valuable, and someone I don't know if they exist. I had always assumed that Har Nelson had recordings of these things, but I was recently listening to an interview with Nat Segaloff, his biographer, who wrote A Lit Fuse, the Har Nelson's biography, and during the interview he referred to the Hour 25 broadcast as kind of you know, they kind of floated out in an atmosphere, and hopefully someone was out there recording them. I had just always assumed that Har Nelson had copies of them, but I actually have copies of many of them on cassettes, and I should really get around to transferring them getting digital copies of them, because they're really valuable. As I said, many of the guests are no longer with us, like Octavia Butler and Robert Sheckley and now Harlan himself.
Yeah, it's interesting. He did all kinds of stuff in addition to his fiction writing. Like you said, he did the Hour 25 broadcasts, and he also did movie criticism with I think it was called the Glass Tit, is what he called the column.
Right, the Glass Tit, the other Glass Tit, those were his television criticisms, which are wonderful. You know, if you go back and read those, even though they're bound by their particular era, the late 1960s, when he wrote them for the LA Free Press, even today, in the context of 2018, if you read them, they're a kind of an amazing diary of his life at the time, because they would often become autobiographical. But also, the criticism that he was writing is just as valid today. All you have to do is just replace the show that he was writing about with whatever is the equivalent show in 2018. You know, if he was writing about the cop show at the time, or the Mod Squad, or, you know, the detective show, whatever it was he was writing about, just transfer it over to 2018 and cross out the title and put in whatever the new show is that's the equivalent, and it's just as relevant today, really.
And, you know, it's interesting. I always found his relationship to science fiction very interesting, because as you pointed out, he really, as cantankerous as his reputation was, he really wanted to help sci-fi authors. But at the same time, if you were to tell Harlan he was a sci-fi writer, he would, like, freak out. He'd get very angry. He's like, I have more in common with Kafka. That's the tradition I'm writing from.
Well, you know what? I think if you've read his fiction, and I've read a lot of the obits and some of the articles, some of which are glowingly positive, some of which are on the opposite end of the spectrum. And I've noticed the most negative ones. There was a particularly negative one in the New Republic about a week ago. Most of the negative ones seem to be written by people who haven't really read his stories. They're sort of reacting to the myth as opposed to actually putting your hands in the dirt and actually reading the stories, you know. He's sort of this weird nexus between high art and low art, between literary fiction and pop art, not dissimilar to Phil Dick. His stories sort of mix the pulp bravado of Walter Gibson and the comic book goofiness of Otto Binder with the sort of enigmatic, mysterious qualities of Kafka or Remedios Varos or Max Ernst or Borges or Calvino. You see all those influences all mixed together, and that's what really fascinates me about his stories. They can take a sudden side turn down a weird side alley, and what started out as this story suddenly becomes a whole new story. If you take one collection, the first short story collection I read of his was my older brother bought me a copy of Angry Candy when it came out, which I think was 1988, as a Christmas gift, and it might be the best Christmas gift I've ever received. And I particularly love that collection, Angry Candy. Not only does it have a consistent theme that goes throughout the entire collection, which is it's all about meditations on death, but the stories are varied. You can turn one page, you're reading a mystery suspense story, and the next story is a supernatural story, and the next story after that is a comedy. And I don't know that if you were not familiar with his writing and you were just given the manuscript blind with no name on it, I'm not sure you would immediately know that it was the same writer who had written all these stories. And that's something that really impresses me. And also stories like Eidolons, which is in Angry Candy, or From A to Z in the Chocolate Alphabet, those stories do exactly what I'm describing. They flip back and forth between that kind of sudden, you'll have a pulp action-adventure sequence side-by-side with some beautifully described, enigmatic description of some metaphysical moment worthy of Borges or Italo Calvino. And it's that kind of variety that really pulls me to the work and makes you want to go back and read it over and over again, and you wonder to yourself, well, how did he pull that off? You try to back engineer it, you know, you read the story multiple times, something like the man who rode Christopher Columbus ashore. You read that multiple times trying to figure out how did he construct this story, and it's almost impenetrable. I was watching the Criterion disc of The Island of Lost Souls, the film with Charles Laughton, the adaptation of The Island of Dr. Moreau by H.G. Wells. And there was a supplement. It was an interview with Mark Mothersbaugh, you know, Devo. And he was talking about how when he and his fellow bandmates formed Devo, they asked themselves, what would it be like if you mixed a German expressionist film with a McDonald's commercial? Like, how evil would that be? And so they based their initial music videos on that concept. And when he said that, I immediately thought, well, I think it would look and sound and taste like a Harn Allison story. If you read something like Whimper Whip Dogs, it's this weird mixture of German expressionism and the mundane, you know. You have these sort of very realistic quotidian details that anchor you to the real world, and then on the periphery there's this sort of unholy metaphysical quality that then invades that very mundane quotidian reality. And Whimper Whip Dogs is a perfect example of that.
The one I think of is I really like Shatter Day, which was later made into a Twilight Zone revival episode with Bruce Willis. And it starts out as this, like, sci-fi story about a guy who's getting overtaken by his doppelganger.
Yes.
But it quickly, like, starts turning into this, like, weird sort of, like, Jungian analysis of the main character. You know, he would just do stuff like that that was, like, it was that mixing of high and lowbrow.
You know, that story inspired a an experiment that I do in my not only in my creative writing classes, but sometimes when I'm teaching composition classes, just the entry level English 100 class that everyone has to take when they enter the university. I do this writing assignment, which I just call the shadow self story, and that is I give them a definition of Carl Jung's concept of the shadow, and then I tell them that they have to write a story in which they meet their own shadow self. So they have to kind of analyze themselves and figure out, well, what is my opposite, you know, and then meet that opposite in a fictional scenario. And sometimes I use Shatter Day as an example. You know, this is a story in which someone encounters their shadow self. If you encountered your shadow self, how would that encounter go? You know, and you get all these kinds of weird variations on that theme. That's one of his best stories. Certainly Shatter Day is in the top three of his collections, I think. And, you know, I was reading one of the more negative newspaper articles I was reading recently. I can't remember where I read this comment, but someone said that he'd been talking to a bookseller, and the bookseller said that Harn Ellison's stories were not, quote, transgenerational, unquote, that younger people couldn't really get into them. And I found that puzzling, because I've actually used some of his stories in my creative writing classes and in my composition classes. I've used Shatter Day and Repent Harlequin, so the TikTok Man, which is a really good story for creative writing students to read, because Repent Harlequin is a story in which all rules are broken. Any rule that you've ever heard of what makes good writing, with a capital G and a capital W, is entirely just tossed out the window. And not only does he toss the rules out the window, but the story is a great story, and he manages to just completely ignore what everyone had ever told him about what not to do in a story, and he did all of it in a single story. And not only was it a good story, it was a great story. And so I've used that story, and I teach a class called Creative Nonfiction, which is where you write autobiographical stories and shape it so that it's entertaining. And so early on, I usually have them read The Three Most Important Things in Life, the autobiographical essay that Harlan wrote, which is about sex, death, and labor relations. And he tells these three stories, which is kind of like a stand-up comedy routine on paper. And the students generally respond well to those stories. And rather than being impenetrable, they're actually drawn to them. And I think the reason for that is that the stories are actually, if you strip away the chaos and the experimentation and the violence that permeates some of his stories, at the core, they're really morality tales. Something like Herodotus, or Shatter Day, or Count the Clock That Tells the Time. I was thinking recently about, I'm a big fan of Lou Reed and Lou Reed's music, and
Velvet Underground. Yeah.
I discovered Harn Ellison and the Velvet Underground around the same time, so they kind of merged into my brain and collided. And Lou Reed, if you look at his music, there's this... on the surface, there's a lot of experimentation and these sonic assaults, but underneath it all, they're really three-chord 50s riffs, you know? And with Harn Ellison's stories, under the phantasmagoria and the violence and the chaos, they're really these simple morality tales. And that's not a criticism. That's a compliment. In other words, those are the types of stories that last. You know, I mean, going back to great mythic tales or Mary Shelley or Poe or Robert Louis Stevenson or Oscar Wilde, those are the stories that continue to last. So as opposed to the idea that they're not accessible to younger people, I would say it's the exact opposite. And I wonder to what extent the negative articles I have read, like the one in the New Republic that I referenced, I wonder to what extent the negativity just stems from a prejudice against science fiction and fantasy. You look around and you think, well, maybe we've gone past that, you know, because obviously most of the big blockbuster films are science fiction and fantasy, right? Or you look at someone like Kelly Link or Jeff Vandermeer, who seems to be able to write science fiction or fantasy-laden stories, but are published by major publishers and reviewed in mainstream publications. And yet, despite that, when I'm reading some of these obituaries about Harren Ellison, I wonder to what extent the negativity comes just from the fact that he wrote fantasy and science fiction for the most part. I mean, we realize that he wrote a lot of outside the field, but in terms of his fiction, what he's known for most of all is his science fiction and fantasy stories.
Yeah, he worked on Star Trek, I believe, at one point, Gene Roddenberry, and he had an argument with Roddenberry over the way the screenplay was going.
Yes, there's a wonderful, if you go to YouTube and just punch in Tom Schneider, Harren Ellison, Star Trek, and you'll find a wonderful segment with Harren Ellison and most of the cast of Star Trek, and Tom Schneider is interviewing the cast of Star Trek about the imminent film, which hadn't yet been done, the motion picture, and the guy who first started the first Star Trek conventions is being there interviewed as well, it's hilarious watching Harren Ellison being the specter at the party, and telling everyone that well, look, Star Trek, it was okay, but really it was just another cop show. And you see Jimmy Doohan respond negatively. They say, "Oh, come on, Harlan, it wasn't a cop show." And then Harlan says, "Yeah, it was a cop show. You're flying around in space, and you were, you know, protecting the universe. It was just a cop show." it's pretty hilarious to watch it play out. But yeah, you know, he won multiple awards across many different media, not just many different genres, you know, winning the Edgar Award for Whimper Whip Dogs, you know, winning the Penn Award for journalism for one of the essays that he wrote in An Edge of My Voice, which was originally serialized in the LA Weekly when the LA Weekly was a good paper. Despite having won all these awards and everything, I was reading that New Republic piece where at the end, the conclusion that the author draws was that, well, he was really at the end just a young adult writer, which I thought was kind of ridiculous, given the fact that his argument was that a lot of people discover him, like I did, you know, when I was 14, and that his stories appeal to that mentality, but that if you go back and read them when you're older, they don't really hold up, which I don't think is the case. And just because a lot of young adults read his stories doesn't mean he's a young adult writer. That's like saying Sylvia Plath and Toni Morrison are young adult writers because young adults often read those writers as well, you know.
Well, there's also been, you mentioned Sylvia Plath. I've known people in academia who have sort of a snooty attitude towards Plath at times, and I'm like, well, I mean, she's accessible. You know, maybe she's angsty, and there's a lot of angst in Harlan's stories at times too. But I don't think that disqualifies them. I think them being accessible is part of what makes them great, because they toe the line between sort of this high mindedness and also being accessible for mass audiences.
Well, you know, there's something to be said for lucidity and accessibility. You know, sometimes I guess in the minds of some literary critics, accessibility means equals bad. And that's just ridiculous. You know, and that's why I say that the mythic qualities of Harren Ellison's stories is what makes them so. I think that they are, quote, transgenerational. I think that 50 years from now, people will still be reading Harren Ellison's short stories because they do have that very accessible mythic quality. And a lot of his stories have a kind of odd metaphysical quality to them. And I know, of course, Harlan was an atheist, and not one to believe in supernatural events or anything. And yet his subconscious was just sort of plugged into this sort of metaphysical mindset. And sort of like H.P. Lovecraft, who Lovecraft himself was a rationalist and an atheist, and yet his stories are so esoterically correct that there are people who are, you know, they're really into magic, and by which I mean not stage magic, but actual, you know, practicing magic, and they actually think that H.P. Lovecraft, you know, actually knew about this stuff or was somehow intimately familiar with the supernatural, just because his stories are so esoterically correct. And Harlan had the same thing. He, his mind, I think his subconscious, was just plugged into the universe in such a way that he was able to write about these metaphysical scenarios in such a way that they feel very real. And he really knew how to use these sort of Jungian symbols, as you mentioned, these Jungian archetypes, and use them in such a way that they feel very real and very new. Sort of like what I was saying before about Lou Reed's music, you know, underneath being three-chord 50s riffs, but they sound startlingly new when you first hear them. And Harlan Ellison had that ability to take something that was really an ancient myth symbol and then put it in a modern context so it spoke to a new generation, which is something that's a long tradition going back to, if we talk about Lovecraft. Lovecraft took the old Gothic form of literature and Radcliffe and turned that upside down and inside out. So you have something like The Color Out of Space where hell is up above, you know, where the heavens should be, and these hellish entities come from the depths of space, which is really a hell, you know. So Lovecraft took the Gothic form and turned it upside down into something new and mixed it with science fiction in something like The Mountains of Madness. And then later on, Fritz Leiber comes along and writes a story like Smoke Ghost or the collection Night's Black Agents or The Girl with the Hungry Eyes, where he took these old supernatural archetypes like the vampire and the ghost and put it in a modern setting set in modern day Chicago in the case of Smoke Ghost. And I know that Harlan Ellison was really influenced by Fritz Leiber, particularly those stories like Smoke Ghost. And I think and Robert Bloch, who comes along and says, you know, in our post-World War II era, who cares about all the supernatural stuff? You know, then suddenly he starts writing The Scarf and Psycho and putting horror in a very realistic context. And then later on you have Harlan Ellison coming along and writing something like The Deathbird Stories, which takes all those things and puts it even in an even newer and even more modern context. And so I think you can see Harlan Ellison's evolution as being a part of a line going from the ancient myths from Homer to Lovecraft to Fritz Leiber and Robert Bloch and culminating in Deathbird Stories, which of course is his masterpiece short story collection, where he really did take all these Jungian archetypes and just explode them and reshape them and reform them into something completely new.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I wanted to get back to the issue of morality tales for a bit here, because you know, there seems to be the image of Harlan Ellison that a lot of people get is that he was sort of like a bitter, cantankerous misanthrope, and I always thought that was odd, because there's a lot of humanism at the heart of the stories he's telling. You know, he's actually very progressive in a lot of ways.
Oh yeah, I was startled by the New Republic piece that I mentioned earlier. There's one line in there where the writer says, "Well, Harlan Ellison was good at writing. He could do angry, he could do violent, he could do confrontations, but he never wrote about love or friendship." And I thought, this is someone who hasn't really read the stuff. You know, he probably read the last paragraph in A Boy and His Dog, and that's it, you know, and then made his conclusions from that. Even A Boy and His Dog is about friendship. You know, ultimately, that is what it's about. Underneath the apocalyptic pre-cyberpunk surface, it's really a story about friendship and the lengths to which you have to go in a, you know, purely survival scenario to protect the person that you actually love. Those themes of friendship and loyalty and morality run throughout the stories. So, I found it very strange in that New Republic piece to hear that actually Harn Ellison didn't write about friendship that much. I thought that was baffling. Also, there's a weird undercurrent in some of the pieces where the piece is entirely about Harlan's personal life or whatever personal foibles he had. They don't seem to be separating the man from the work. I know that in Dreams with Sharp Teeth, the documentary that was made by, I believe, Eric Davis, there's a point in there where Neil Gaiman says you can't separate Harlan from his work, that Harlan was creating this long performance art piece called Harn Ellison. And to some extent that's true, but ultimately at the end of the day, the words on the page are the words on the page, you know. And I think that as time goes on and the myths that have grown up around Harn Ellison, as they sort of fade into the background, I think people will be able to evaluate the words on the page. It could be that some of the more literary mainstream critics who have accepted people like Philip K. Dick, Philip K. Dick is a fairly respectable figure in science fiction. I mean, you could easily get away with doing your PhD thesis on Philip K. Dick, no problem. If you wanted to do it on Harn Ellison, it might be a little more difficult. I was teaching a science fiction class at CSU Long Beach not long ago, and just out of curiosity, I asked all the students who had chosen, you know, I mean, these are people who chosen to take a literature of science fiction class. I asked them, how many people have heard of Philip K. Dick? Everyone had heard of Philip K. Dick, even if they'd never read him, they'd heard of him. I then asked them, how many of you have heard of Harn Ellison? And only a few had heard of Harn Ellison, and these were people who were science fiction fans. I think that there's, you know, I think that some literary mainstream critics were perhaps put off by the kind of Carnival Barker side of Harn Ellison's personality. You know, there's one episode that he was on with Tom Schneider where he said something I thought was interesting. He said that he felt there were two parts of his personality. There was the artist who writes the story, and then once the artist was done writing the story, he had to step aside, and then the rapacious businessman would take over, you know, to then promote the work. And so perhaps that rapacious businessman side, which I think was probably necessary, and there's a lot of artists who can't do that, and as a result, they remain fairly obscure because they don't have that rapacious businessman aspect of themselves, you know. But Harlan had that and was able to use it to his advantage. But perhaps it's that rapacious businessman side of his personality that repulses the more, you know, mainstream literary critic. And it has prevented them from just sitting down and actually evaluating the words on the page. So I think that as the myth recedes and what Neil Gaiman calls the performance art aspect of Harn Ellison's life, as that recedes, the words will remain, and I think he will be more and more recognized as time goes on, just like Phil Dick has been recognized.
Well, I want to start wrapping up with you know, recommendations for some of my younger listeners or some of my listeners who may not be as familiar with Harlan Ellison. What stories would you recommend they read to get into Harlan's work?
Definitely, you can't go wrong with Deathbird Stories. Brilliant collection. It's one of those collections where every story, he's hitting it out of the park. And every story, it's like whatever. Imagine that record. Imagine that album that you love, where every single song is a 10. That's what Deathbird Stories is. Every single song is a 10. And Angry Candy as well, and Shatterday. I think those three are at the top. And if you want to delve into the nonfiction, I think An Edge of My Voice is sort of a master class in essay writing, and that book contains the piece that he won the Silver Pen Award for. I think those are four really good books to start with.
And you know, I'm probably gonna, maybe I'll sound off base saying this, but I would also recommend people play the video game that he wrote. I Have No Mouth, But I'm a Scream, which was based on the short story. Yeah, he could work in all kinds of different mediums. That's the great thing about Harlan Ellison.
Yeah, yeah, and it's even particularly more impressive when you know that he hated video games.
Right, right. Well, he wanted I Have No Mouth, But I'm a Scream. He apparently told the producers of it, he wanted to make a game where you couldn't possibly win it.
that perfectly matches the theme of the story, of course.
Right, right, exactly.
The most existential science fiction story ever written.
Yeah, it's a story about like an AI supercomputer that sort of is torturing you know, these people on Earth like years into the future. I don't know how to sum it up really. It's a weird one.
It's interesting. I remember hearing him say one time that he wrote that that it wasn't clear to him when he wrote a story if the story he had just written was just going to be like one of the classics, or was it just going to be considered just a sort of middling story. And that when he wrote I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream, he didn't have any particular great affection for it. He wrote it, and then I think Frederick Pohl published it, and yet there are other stories that he writes where he finishes it and he's like, oh my God, this is amazing, I really hit it out of the park. And he goes, but no one ever mentions those stories. So it's just interesting how a writer sometimes is not in a position to be able to judge their own work. In that particular case, he was referring to the story Grail, which is actually a fantastic story. That's in Stalking the Nightmare. Which also, Stalking the Nightmare, by the way, is a great collection to read just because it has one of his greatest introductions, which is called Quiet Lies, The Locust Tells. And that story, Grail, is in Stalking the Nightmare. And that is a fantastic story and rarely anthologized. Giving credit where credit is due, Harlan cites Grail as one of his own personal favorites, and it is in fact a great story. So perhaps read Grail as well.
Could you give a brief synopsis of what it is, or like how would you describe
Grail?
Yes,
it's a man's search for his one true love across the centuries. And where that leads him, and it's ultimately tragic, as many of Harlan's stories were.
Well, he was a great writer, and you know, I think you know, time's going to show that 50 years from now, people will be reading Harlan Ellison, and whoever wrote that obituary in the New Republic, I don't think people will be reading him.
You know, when I read the piece, when I finished it, I thought back to if you go back and read articles that were written about, say, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, that were written back in the 20s, and very, very critical articles about, why do these people read Sherlock Holmes? You know, just completely tone deaf and clueless. You know, and predicting that, you know, in 100 years from now, no one's going to be reading Sherlock Holmes stories, and it's just for. It's just for children and et cetera, et cetera. And of course now we are in 2018 and everyone still knows who Sherlock Holmes is because Arthur Conan Doyle's stories had that accessible quality that you're talking about that you referenced earlier. And I think that, Harlan's stories, are the same, they're on the same level as Doyle in the sense of the accessibility and in their durability. And in the fact that that mythic core that exists in most of the stories is the type of thing that survives and is in fact transgenerational. And I do think that 100 years from now, people will still be reading Harlan Ellison's short stories.
And of course, I think he'll be influencing writers like yourself. You've written a few sci-fi novels, and I think he's going to continue having an influence on people.
Yeah, and even Jeff Vandermeer posted something on Facebook the day that Harnelson died, and Vandermeer said that he had conflicting feelings about Harlan, not only him as a person, but his stories as well. But ultimately, at the end, Vandermeer said that Harnelson did influence him in one important way, and that was simply to be the writer that he wanted to be, no matter what anyone else thought, to be the writer that you feel you ought to be. And what could be a better lesson? You know, what could be a more important lesson to any writer than to take that to heart? You know, don't listen to what the agents or the publishers or what's popular, or don't write what you think is going to be a bestseller. Just write the story or the novel that you think needs to be told, particularly that thing that no one else is doing, and just do it, not caring what anyone thinks about it. Well, that's the most important lesson that you could learn from another writer.
And that sort of gets at what I was trying to say earlier about, I think people confuse his sort of cantankerous character that he played and don't understand that. I always got the impression that Harlan was cantankerous because he always wanted people to be the best they could be, and he always thought that people had more potential than they allowed themselves to. They didn't allow themselves to blossom the way he thought they could.
That's a good point, particularly related to that episode of Hour 25 I was telling you about, where he did the creative writing workshop. Because some people would complain, I guess, that when he taught workshops, say at Clarion, that he could be very, very critical. In a way that would almost destroy the writer's psyche, you know, but that you kind of have to endear that type of thing if you want to become a better writer. And I see a tendency in some of my students when I teach creative writing workshops in the first couple of weeks is that the students will their initial instinct is to be very kind to one another. So they'll say things like, even if they don't like the story, they'll go, oh, well, I really like the paper that you used. It's 8.5 by 11. That's nice. And you can read all the words. They'll try to just grasp for straws to say something nice because they, in their mind, think that when their story is up, if they're critical, then they're going to get the lash back at them. So they try to be nice to everyone so that everyone will be nice to them when their story is up. And you can't do that. If you want to improve as a writer, you have to be willing to be honest with the other people, and then allow the other people in the workshop to be honest with you. And the way you have to walk that line then between being critical of the work and not being critical of the person. So some people say that Harlan would sometimes cross the line and attack the writer, you know. And perhaps he did, perhaps he didn't. I don't know. I never experienced him as a teacher in a workshop scenario, except for hearing that broadcast. But I've learned that there's a way of doing that in the creative writing workshop where you can be brutally honest, but not totally destroy the person and leave them a quivering mass of protoplasm wanting to jump off a tall building. But I really have to kind of prod them. In the beginning of the semester, at the beginning of the workshop, I kind of have to prod them to get them to be critical of the stories, you know. And I think that's something that Harnelson would do as well, is say, hey, you know, you can't just hide behind false niceness because you don't want to be criticized. you have to put yourself out there and be willing to be criticized and take the criticism if you want to grow and evolve. So I would totally agree with the point you just made.
And it's not. I would even go beyond the way he wanted to help writers. I would say, you know, he marched with the civil rights protesters in the 60s, from what I've heard. He helped a lot of, like, female sci-fi authors. You know, he just seemed to he seemed to have a heart of gold masked in, like, that angry get off my lawn sort of shtick.
Oh yeah, well, you know, it's sort of similar to Hunter S. Thompson. In the sense that you always got the sense that what's that old saw about, you know, inside every pessimist is a wounded idealist, you know, behind every cynic is a wounded idealist, that they have this ideal as to what the world and what people should be, and that people so often fall so low of that ideal that they become frustrated and angry and disillusioned, you know. I don't think Harn Ellison ever became a self-server as a result. You know, there are endless stories from people who knew him, like J. Michael Straczynski and Stephen Barnes and Samuel Delaney and Ellen Datlow, people who worked with him. Endless stories of his kindnesses, his random acts of kindness to not just strangers, but to, you know, other young writers like Octavia Butler, who he gave her the money to go to Clarion. You know, who knows if he hadn't done that, maybe Octavia Butler wouldn't have evolved on the path that she evolved on, you know, and she's just one example. There are other writers who he helped in that way too. And not in a way where he was out bragging about it, you know. He would do it quietly because he felt it was the right thing to do. So, yeah, I agree with you.
Dan Simmons is another one that he really helped out, from what I understand.
Absolutely. Yes, I remember him. In fact, around that time period of listening to Hour 25, he was heavily telling people to go out and read Song of Kali, which had been published as an obscure sort of paperback, I believe. I'm not even sure it was published in hardcover initially. But he would almost every week tell people to go out, read Song of Kali, you know. And I think that really did help and propel Dan Simmons' career.
Well, I'll let you get the last word on Harlan Ellison and what you think his legacy will be.
I think his legacy will be as one of the great myth makers of the 20th and early 21st century in that tradition of Mary Shelley and Poe. And that there's that Philip Jose Farmer quote that Philip Jose Farmer wrote an article about Ellison for the Los Angeles Times, where he said he's the modern day Lewis Carroll. I think it's that tradition: Lewis Carroll, Mary Shelley, Edgar Allan Poe, H.P. Lovecraft. He was a master fantasist, and you know, he sometimes referred to himself as a magic realist. And I think there's those strains as well: Borges, Calvino, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, the surrealist painters, Dali and Max Ernst, Remedios Varos. You see all these influences intermingling in his stories, and I think that's for that reason, for that unique quality to his writing, it will survive, because his stories are like nothing else. You can't confuse a Harn Ellison story with anyone else's story, and you can't really give a writer a higher compliment than that, of being completely and totally unique.
Well, Robert Guffey, I want to thank you for coming on the Parallax Views podcast to celebrate the life and times of Harlan Ellison.
I thank you for having me on. I enjoyed it.
Let's go on to the idea of people who want to be writers. Everyone wants to be a writer. And just to be serious for a moment, do you have advice to people? I mean, you talk about the college kids. They must come up to you and say, Mr. Ellison, we love it, we love it. How do you do it? Where's the magic box? Please tell us how to do it.
I will tell you exactly what I say to them, and I will say it to the audience. In this life, there are three things everybody knows they can do better than anybody else: drive a car, fuck, and write. They all know they're great at all three of those things, when in fact, all three of those take great skill. Now, when I do a college lecture, invariably there will be some yo-yo. The most frequently asked question is, where do you get your ideas? And I always give the same answer: Schenectady. And people say, yeah, there's this idea service in Schenectady. I send them $25 a week, and like clockwork, they send me a fresh six-pack of ideas every week. And invariably, there'll be some asshole who'll come up afterward, ask me for the address.
I know it.
Okay, so now they'll come up to me, and they'll be wide-eyed, and they're like Willie Loman in Death of a Salesman talking to his brother Ben. The secret, Ben, what's the secret? Diamonds, Willie, diamonds. I went into the jungle, hewed an empire out of the jungle with diamonds, Willie, it's diamond. The answer is, and I give them the truth: you want to be smart, don't read the Bible, don't read The One-Minute Manager, don't read How to Influence Friends and Make People you know, Kiss Your Ass. What you read is you read the Arthur Conan Doyle Sherlock Holmes stories. You read the entire canon. They're not that many. You read the entire canon, and you will be smarter than you ever need to be, because every one of them is based on the idea of deductive logic. Keep your eyes open and be alert. That's what all good writing says. Wake up and pay attention. Pay attention. Pay attention. That's all it is. That's what good writing is. I tell them, if you want to really write, what you should do is you should get yourself an honest job. Not one of these, I'm a computer designer, or I'm a systems analyst. I'm bullshit. And when I'm doing a college thing, I'll have 1,500 people. How many of you have an actual honest job in which you work with your hands? Nobody who works in computers, raise your hand. And there are three people who raise their hand. One will say, I'm a midwife. And someone will say, I'm a housewife. And then someone will say, well, I drive a taxi. Those are honest jobs. Everybody else is sitting on their giant fat asses eating junk food and talking to themselves in isolation, and they think it's wonderful. Wonderful. Thank God I'm going to die soon. Yes, I know you're saying we're grateful too. That for you. Anyhow, the rest of you are laughing your asses off, and you're the ones I'm talking to. Anyhow, I say to them, you promise yourself you're going to do 1,000 words a night. Don't go for more. And if always quit when you're hot. Never quit when you're cold. Never finish the scene. If you're going to say, and he went to kill her, and he said to her, stop. Stop, and you'll never have a writer's block. Because if you stop, when you come back to write, you're not cold. You're not starting from a dead stop. This is good advice. This is good writing advice. And it's simple. There's no great secret. Trust me on this. There is no great secret. We do not go into the attic at dead midnight with a chamois bag filled with the knuckle bones of an orangutan and cast the runes and magically come down in the morning with a story. We sit there on our ass and write. It is labor, hard physical labor. When you do it, you sweat it out, you write it well, you cut it, you excise it, then you got something. And you got an actual manuscript in your hands, and they don't listen. It's a generation of people, kids, who think everything is they deserve everything. They don't know why they deserve it, but they just deserve it. They've been told they deserve it.
They don't even know why they deserve it, but they deserve it.
They deserve it, and they're pissed off when they don't get it. They're annoyed when they don't get everything without even having to work. Well, hey, man, it's not fair. Fuck you, fair. Universe is not fair. The universe... You may like to think there's a God out there watching to see if things are done right, but there ain't no such animal. Trust me, folks. Mark Twain said, if you really believe there is some bearded deity sitting out there in a cloud watching to see if you masturbate or whatever it is, you know, you're going to be very disappointed, because if you do and you look around you at the condition of the world, you are forced to the ineluctable conclusion that God is a malign thug. Well, in truth, the idea is you rule your own domain. You are the only one who is responsible for what you can do. Absolutely. None of these people that you go and you pay thousands of dollars to tell you how to develop yourselves and est and revivify. It's all there. Don't be dumb. The smarter you are, the easier you can live your life. The dumber you are, the more you're somebody's tool. If you're my tool, I'm going to use you. That's what it's all about. But if you're smart, you can get on in life. You can do whatever you want. You want to write? Write. You want to be a brain surgeon? Be a brain surgeon. Sculpt, dance, anything you want to do, you can do it. They keep telling you you can't do it, or there's some secret, or somebody's lucky and you're not lucky. Ain't no such thing as luck. The universe is neither benign nor malign. It doesn't know you're here, kid. It doesn't know it at all. It's turned a blind eye. It's out there busy making the coal sack and making dark spots. It doesn't know you're here. You're going to have to do it on your own. You can't do it on your own? Tough titty.
And fuck them if they can't take a job.
And fuck them if they can't take a cheesecake.
And the cheesecake.
And that was an extended clip from an interview with Harlan Ellison on the TV show Dark Dreamers, hosted by Stanley Weotter, that I think perfectly caps off the Parallax Views tribute to Harlan Ellison. I hope you enjoyed my conversations with not only John Barbour and Robert Guffey, but also the previous conversations in the last episode with Ben Arzadi, Joshua Ellis, and C. Derek Varn. Here's to the life and legacy of Harlan Ellison. Until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax.
The way out is not simply to say, don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.